This is Talk To Me, the podcast that gives you rants, anecdotes, and interviews with people from hardcore to hair metal. And now your hosts, Joshua Toomey and John Drake.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Talk To Me. This is episode 121. As always, I am your host, Joshua Toomey, and joined by the gentleman that has not slept since Monday night, since the Star Wars trailer came out.
John Drake. I have slept. I've just watched it like, I don't know, 37,428 times.
Are you looking for the hidden meanings in it behind everything and looking in the background for something crazy going on?
I have to admit, yes. I'm trying to see like what's in the background because there's so much stuff to kind of like dissect and see what's going on, because everyone's going to speculate, oh, this has happened to this character, this happened to that character, but they try and really mess with your head with these trailers anymore to not give away what's really happening, so you kind of go through it. So I wouldn't normally do it like that, but because I have a show, I kind of have to, so
right.
I got to throw out my opinions.
So what about Chewbacca and the Porg flying the Millennium Falcon? You like that?
I don't know if the Porg is necessarily flying it, but that's been rumored a long time that Chewbacca's hanging out with some Porgs. So I was
as he tends to do.
I thought it was kind of funny how like Chewbacca does that howl and then the Porg imitates him basically. So, you know.
All right, well, let's get into the show this week, and that is Jared Montague, former drummer of Taproot and the author of True Rock Stars, 12 Guiding Principles for Success and Happiness. So we have another author on the show. That's always nice. But, man, I was always a huge Taproot fan. I loved the first couple of albums through through the entire time that Jared was in the band, and got to see him a few times live. So I always enjoyed some Taproot.
Yeah, I know they were big on the radio back in the early 2000s when my band was trying to get signed and all that. So I know my bandmates went and saw them live a bunch of times. So cool band. You know, I haven't heard a lot of their music, honestly. No one ever really turned me on to it. So being more of a rock guy, I never got to listen to a lot of their stuff. So
yeah, well, they were good.
Cool interview though.
Yeah, they were fun to it was also when Toby Wright was on too. I got to talk to Toby about. I guess he produced Welcome by Taproot, so that was always nice, and then it played some Taproot on that episode, so cool to get one of the gentlemen from Taproot on the episode. So let's head on over to iTunes and check out the iTunes review for the week, and it is a nice 5-star review, short and sweet, from Big John Lamb, 5 stars, perfect for metalheads. Josh knows his stuff, and his passion is infectious for fellow metalheads. Quick, easy,
very nice.
5 stars. So if you guys want your iTunes review read on the next episode or a future episode of the podcast, make sure you're heading over to iTunes, leaving a nice 5-star rating and a nice 5-star review, and it will be much appreciated.
Yep. 5-star reviews are always good. Bump us up those rankings.
All right.
Is that what it is, rankings?
Yeah, I mean, it does factor in into the rankings of the show and where we show up in the... When people search out a metal podcast, you know, they tend to, the higher the rated the show, the more chances people will be to stumble upon the show. And we appreciate everyone that's ever stumbled upon the show.
Definitely. Yeah, I just want to make sure I'm phrasing it right. I'm an Android guy, so I've never really done anything with iTunes. I don't want to misspeak.
Yeah, you better not, because the ghost of Steve Jobs will come and get you.
If he hasn't gotten me by now, he's not going to get me, because I haven't owned a single Apple product in my life except for an Apple IIc computer when I was like 8 years old.
I was like those Apple computers at school where you could play like Oregon Trail, and there was like a fishing game where like the fish would eat the other fish kind of game. I don't remember what that was called. I'm sure it was called like fishing, because back right? in the 80s,
called. Maybe was it fishing?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's how the video games were back in the 80s. I mean, they basically, if you were, playing tennis, the game was called tennis. And if it was about a tank, it was called tank. It's, they didn't really put too much into the names of the games. They just flat out told you what the game was about.
Right? I just remember playing Where in the World Was Carmen or Where in the World Is Carmen Sandiego on those computers.
That was fun.
And thinking, oh, this has graphics. Look at that. There's people in the picture. Yeah, how amazing.
Yeah, those graphics now look terrible. But then they also had the show that came on, I think, when you got home from school. That was always a good show.
I never got into it because I liked the video game so much better. I was like, this isn't any fun. There's no intrigue here. I was just a total shill for the game, so the show never did much for me.
You're one of those guys.
I am. A purist.
Purist. All right, and the purest form of flattery for the show is a nice shout-outs for sharing. All right, let's get into our shout-outs for sharing. That is shout-outs for sharing on Facebook and Twitter. So if you see this pop up in your Facebook timeline, your Twitter feed, make sure to hit that share button, hit that retweet button, and you will get a shout-out on the next episode of the Talk To Me podcast. So for shouting out the mighty Max Cavalera episode and Greg Renoff, goes to the following. Rico Kohler, Danny Gilliatt, Eric Daly, Greg Renoff himself, and the Van Halen Rising page shared it. Nice. Mike Grabowski, Alan Tate of the Ages of Rock podcast, Daniel Terry and Discography Discussion, Eric Moore and the Saturday Night Jam Session podcast, Rick Lancaster, Zach from Bleed TV, and I'm looking forward to Bleed TV will be basically starting back up because they're they do pop culture type movies and TV, and they do a great Walking Dead podcast, so that'll be great. Daniel Chaput, Alex Sander, Will McGraw, Chris Sinzak of the Decibel Geek podcast, Sonny Pooney and Growing Up Rock podcast, Donnie Greenwell, AC, that's at AAULT1 on Twitter, MDG Rock Photography, Ear Peeler, our good friend Vic over there at Ear Peeler, Adam Splitter PR, and our good friends at the Classic Metal Show. So
very cool.
Very cool. And then also want to give another shout out too, because over the weekend, the band Dead, they shared their episode of the Talk To Me podcast from Louder Than Life. Fire From The Gods shared it, and my good friend, Jose Mangan, not only shared it, but he also had nice words to say about me and being an old friend and stuff like that. So that was nice of him to, you know, he shared it on his personal page, on his fan page, and his personal Twitter. So that was nice of him to share in all those spots.
It's cool because the list seems to get longer and longer as we go. So that's a good sign. Much appreciated, everyone.
Very much appreciated. I appreciate that. You're appreciated, everyone.
We're so gracious.
We are gracious.
Do you think Nathan from Kentucky shared it?
You know what? I never see him on this list. I don't know. I don't know why.
I don't know. He seems like such a good guy.
Well, I would not say Nathan from Kentucky and gracious in the same line.
Right? I guess
I definitely, you know, it's
sarcasm
funny.
Sarcasm there.
It's funny, you know, he gets called out by Dave Mustaine of Megadeth for having untruths in his article that he did about Megadeth. And then now, you know, some other untruths have come out. So it's kind of, you know, for being a journalist, there are a lot of holes in his stories.
Imagine that. Well, I think he's learning a lesson that if you're going to talk shit about somebody, make sure you are sure who the person you're talking shit to doesn't have daily contact with whoever you're trying to throw under the bus. Because, you know, we'll just leave it at that.
Right. But. All right. Well, let's jump into something a little bit more important, and that's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I know that's up there in the Cleveland area, and I know that you must go there at least once a week, right? Because you're such a huge rock fan. And that being in your backyard, I mean, you have to go there all the time, right?
I walk past it several times a year because it's right on my walk to Cleveland Browns Stadium. But yeah, I've actually only been one time. Ironically, well, no, that's not true. I played there twice.
There you go.
So I've played there twice, and I visited just as like a I'm going to the Rock Hall type thing once. So I have been in there three times.
Well, cool. Well, this is a alphabetical list, so it's not in the list in the order that I would say it, but we'll go in the list that's presented here. And so five people get in. Let's see if we can make five out of this list. Starts with Bon Jovi.
That's pretty much a no-brainer.
No-brainer as in?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen people argue that one online, and that one makes no sense, how you can tell me that Bon Jovi, out of all those bands that came out in the 80s that basically carried the rock, the hard rock flag, the hair metal flag throughout all those years and had all that success, and, you know, still be able to sustain that success, and wrote some pretty catchy tunes. So, yeah, Bon Jovi's a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, I mean, they're almost like, I mean, you got Pearl Jam, and their career is, God, not 8 or 10 years shorter than Bon Jovi's, but they're basically the same thing, just as a different genre of music. They're still selling records. They're still playing arenas and stadiums, and, you know, Pearl Jam's a Hall of Fame band, so you got to put Bon Jovi in there.
Right. There's a whole lot of if these guys are in, these guys should have been in before type stuff. So Bon Jovi's a yes, so that's one. Kate Bush. I don't even know anything about Kate Bush.
I don't either.
So no one Kate Bush, the Cars.
Yeah. I would say the Cars for sure.
I think the Cars are in my, if there are four, then yes, they could be number five. But I think, you know, they definitely had some hits too, so I will definitely put a nice asterisk next to the Cars for the time being. Depeche Mode.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'm not feeling that one either. Dire Straits.
I don't know enough about them outside of the couple really popular tunes. So that's another one. I mean, it could be. But
I think it just for the Money for Nothing riff. I think they should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That awesome video.
You know, Mark Knopfler just killing it there. Yeah, you definitely need some Mark Knopfler, like, doing that one. All right, so that's another in the possible pile. The Eurythmics are up next.
Again, a lot of these bands, it's like, I know of them and I know they're big hits, but I'm wondering, like, how long were they big and how influential were they? I mean, like, you compare him against Bon Jovi, who's got that huge career with tons of, what, like 100 million record album sales and all these number one hits, and it. So that's obvious. But these other ones, like, man, that's tough.
I think so far, if you were to ask me, I think so far Bon Jovi, and I'm a big fan of the Eurythmics, so I think that. I think that they did a lot of great stuff, and they were kind of, you know, they were dark for their time, stuff like that. So I think the Eurythmics are definitely in my top two here so far. Jay Giles Band.
Yeah, I would put them in there. They were kind of like a poor man's version of Bob Seger in a way, to me.
All right, and then on to Judas Priest.
Yeah, that's number two.
That's a no-brainer.
Putting the Eurythmics above Judas Priest, you're high.
Well, it's alphabetical order, so you can't really take that away.
But you just said the Eurythmics were number two.
So far in the list. So
you knew Judas Priest was in there. You're right. Biased.
Yes.
Your credibility is shot.
Ah, damn it. All right, and then on to LL Cool J.
No. This one falls under the category of it's not rock and roll. Enough with the rap. Enough with the hip hop. It's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Get that shit out of there. Even I mean, if there's a rap Hall of Fame, he's totally in, 100%. But a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, not a chance.
See, I think this is the one where I, you know, if this band is in, then you have to have this band in too, kind of thing. And I think if you're going to allow NWA and Tupac in, I think LL Cool J is right there. And if he is not, you know, more, you know, Mama Said Knock You Out and all that stuff, you know, going back to Cali, and, you know, he actually had more of a, even in the Def Jam, Rick Rubin era of music there too. So, I mean, you know, if you got to let NWA and Tupac in, you're going to have to start letting LL Cool J in. You're going to, Dr. Dre will be in solo, and Snoop Dogg is going to be in. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, that logic is sound, but NWA and Tupac, I said the same thing. It's not rock and roll. It doesn't belong in there. If there, again, same thing. If there's a rap Hall of Fame or a hip hop Hall of Fame, total first ballot, legendary, has to be in there. Yeah. But the Rock Hall, come on. Not even close. I don't know why they're even doing that. I mean, that's the problem I have with the Rock Hall. It's like the WWE Hall of Fame. They just shove people in there because, oh, well, we got to have five every year. Or we got to have this many.
Isn't Trump in the WWE Hall of Fame?
Yeah. Pete Rose is in the WWE Hall of Fame. There's all these guys that just were like, they showed up as a joke, and then they make it into the WWE Hall of Fame. And that's what these rap guys are like for me in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're not a joke, but they're not rock and roll, so keep them the hell out. It just ruins the credibility of the whole thing.
I liked Ice Cube's speech when he was saying that, you know, they had the essence of rock and roll, and then that they were rock and roll because of their outlook and, you know, being against the man type stuff, and, you know, a rebellious attitude that rock and roll always had. So that's what made them rock and roll. I did enjoy Ice Cube's acceptance speech or induction speech, but you know, I guess we'll differ on LL Cool J, and then we'll move on to the MC5.
Yeah, they were pretty influential. I mean, if you read a whole bunch of biographies from bands that were starting out in like the early to mid 80s, mm-hmm. they're mentioning the MC5 all the time.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
So just based on what came after them and what they spawned, I would have to say that's probably a good one.
All right, the Meters.
I have no idea who that is, which means they'll probably get in.
Right, and they're probably a shoo-in. The Moody Blues.
The shoo-in. Moody Blues for sure. I don't know how rock and roll they are, but definitely. I mean, another band with a career that's just spanned decades and decades. So, you know, a lot of hits, still big, so.
All right, here's the one that this one will probably get in, but I don't know if it's first ballot Hall of Fame kind of worthy, but Radiohead. I'm a fan, so yeah. So
that's a really cool band. It's God, that's a hard one because they're kind of weird. So,
very weird.
Yeah, I mean, on sheer creativity alone, they definitely belong.
Mm-hmm.
They're more rock and roll than LL Cool J, so I'll say I'd put them in.
Rage Against the Machine.
They'll go in.
You think their
Everybody
first ballot?
And their brother was into that band.
Yeah.
Maybe not on the first, but I mean, everybody and their brother was all about that. That was like the cool kid band back in like when I was in high school. You know, all the yuppie kids got a hold of that record and were like, look how cool I am. And I'm like, fuck off. You don't know anything about heavy music. Give me that.
I'm gonna lump the next four in because I don't want to waste a lot of time. Rufus featuring Chaka Khan, Nina no. Simone, Sister no. Rosetta Tharpe, and Link Ray.
Where do they find these goddamn artists?
Oh, and the Zombies.
No.
Which actually, I do believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the current guitar player in the Zombies, his name is Tim Toomey. So I might have to just vote for him for my for my namesake.
Solidarity.
So
yeah. No, I just none of those.
All right, so we've got Bon Jovi, Judas Priest, MC5, Moody Blues, Rage Against the Machine. That's five. And then the Eurythmics, I think, was... Well, the Eurythmics and Dire Straits, I think, was on the edge.
The Cars.
So I would probably knock out the Moody Blues and put in either the Cars or the Eurythmics.
Dude, you cannot take out the Moody Blues in favor of the Eurythmics. I don't care if you're a fan. Quit making it worse for yourself.
I'll take out the Eurythmics and put in LL Cool J.
For one that was around like 10.
Why not? And it was 20, at least 25.
You can't do that.
You just said that the Moody Blues may or may not even be rock and roll.
Well, that's true. But
so if they can have a Moody Blues Hall of Fame, then they can be in that Hall of Fame. That's the same logic as the LL Cool J.
Soft rock, I guess. Right?
Nice.
Well, they are soft rock. So technically, if you're going by genre, it has rock in the title. So that should be good for some votes.
Nice. All right. Well, let's get into our Talk To Me cover of the week. And then we'll get into our talk with Jared Montague. Hopefully no Capulets running around. But we'll talk to Jared Montague of Taproot.
Good for you.
Thank you. I watched Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and the other girl in it.
See, you didn't have to say that. You should have just been like, yeah, I was reading my Shakespeare the other day. I actually enjoy it.
I remember like the first time my teacher ever cussed in class, and that was like in the ninth grade. And our teacher was trying to explain a rose by any other name would still smell as sweet. And she goes, you could call a rose a piece of shit, but it's still going to smell like a rose. And I'm in the ninth grade, and I'm like, my eyes are probably like silver dollars. I'm like, did my teacher just press? But
this is officially the coolest teacher, a teacher I will ever have.
But you know what? I still remember that to this day. And so that I know that a rose by any other name would still smell as sweet. Because if you call Rose a piece of shit, he'll still smell like a rose.
Well, it got you to remember Shakespeare, so I guess it was an effective teaching technique.
All right, well, let's do, since we've been talking about the Eurythmics, and poor Marilyn Manson hurt himself, not like 2 days yep. in a row. He's canceled 9 dates and a festival appearance. So let's do the Talk To Me cover of the week, brought to you by Puck Hockey. That's PUCKHCKY.com. Head over there and check out all of the great stuff, all of the Snoop Dogg, 36 Crazy Fists, Tom Hazard, David Ellefson, who posted a picture of me. Did you see that picture that I posted?
I did see that. That was cool, man.
Yeah, my buddy Jeremy's out driving. He drives buses, and he's driving for Megadeth right now, so I'm sure Dave loved having to hold a picture of me as he's getting his picture taken to be sent. But make sure to check out the Talk To Me podcast Instagram and Talk To Me Facebook page, and I'll have that up there. And you can see a picture of David Ellefson holding a picture of me drinking a cup of Ellefson Co. coffee. So, and actually, that coffee was really good, but that's beside the point. Yeah, head over there, get yourself some Dave Ellefson stuff, 36 Crazy Fists, Doyle. And Head PE and Exodus and Testament and all kinds of great bands. And they just, believe they just put out some Darkest Hour stuff. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So shop till you drop. Use the promo code TALK AS IN TALK TO ME for 10% off your entire order. Yes, that is TALK AS IN TALK TO ME for 10% off your entire order. So the Talk To Me cover of the week this week is Marilyn Manson doing Sweet Dreams.
Very cool.
Some of them want to be.
have Jared Montague on the line from former Tapper drummer and now author of True Rockstar's 12 Guiding Principles for Success and Happiness. How you doing, Jared?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate being part of the show. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, no problem, man. I've been keeping up with the books ever since I've seen like excerpts coming up. Been reading every time they pop up, man. And from what I can tell, you're an incredible writer, and you're very good at telling the story of the early days of Taproot.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. This is a little bit new territory for me. I had the idea of writing a book a while ago. Just a lot of people that I've met, even in my post-Taproot years, have said, wow, you have a really interesting story that you went from pre-med wanting to be a doctor, then got a record deal, so kind of dropped out of med school to go do the whole rock and roll thing, and then, you know, left rock and roll to go raise a family and go into the corporate world. And a lot of people asked, how'd you do that, or what was the story? So a few people said, oh, you should write a book. So I kind of started documenting an autobiography, I guess I'd call it. And so I certainly don't consider myself a writer, but I did have a good high school English teacher named Mrs. Porter. So I learned a lot from getting red ink on lots and lots of papers over the years.
Nice.
And so, you know, it was a really long project to do, a really fun project to do. And I know there's much better writers out there, but I do take a little bit of pride as I've been kind of seeing what other kind of rock books there are out there. If you really start paying attention, there's just tons of ghostwriters out there, or, you know, people that are in rock bands or celebrities that work with a professional author to kind of tell their story. And I definitely wanted to be my own, and I also decided to self-publish. So, you know, I'm pretty happy that I was able to put together a full book kind of by myself, and, you know, there's nobody else telling me what I should or shouldn't put into it. So I thought that was really cool. That's a cool part about it.
Yeah. And I actually just got done reading a few little blurbs from it about before we started. And I don't want to jump too far ahead in the story, but the one that kind of caught me the most right now is, you know, where you say you left Taproot and I guess you went to GM, because you guys are up there in the Detroit area, so I'm sure the car industry is still huge up there. But the one thing that caught me was, you know, where you're working at GM, but then Taproot releases an album without you, and it charted on Billboard, and it's hard to kind of see that success when you're, you know, being the corporate guy. And, you know, I left music in, I guess, roughly around the same time as you did, and started a family. Yeah. And started, you know, I think I became like a general manager at Papa John's, you know, for a while. And
right.
it was hard to be like, well, yeah, I work here, but really I played in this band and I did all this touring and stuff. And so I kind of gravitated, yep, towards that blurb.
Yeah, it was a really strange feeling. I think in the excerpt you're talking about, I compared it to, you know, you went through a breakup in a relationship, and you know it was for the best, but it's still really weird to see your ex-spouse or your ex-girlfriend with somebody else, but you know it was still the right decision. So, yeah, I, you know, we were on tour with Stained and POD, which was an awesome tour, and I guess that would have been, they called it Fall Brawl Tour, so that would have been October, November of 2005, and, you know, actually, at the end of that tour, we were supporting our third Atlantic Records release, Blue Sky Research, and we had spent a year on it. We'd spent all kinds of money on it, stayed in LA the whole time, and it just didn't sell as well as we expected it to, or Atlanta expected it to. So, you know, we had kind of incurred all of this debt from making the record, and, you know, the interesting thing about the music business, and I talk quite a bit about the music business in the book, so people that are interested in that will really learn a lot of the mechanics and even some of the financial side of things, which I've always found really interesting. You know, I always thought when I was a kid that if you saw a band on MTV, well, they must be millionaires. And, you know, exactly. I kind of go into a lot of detail. Exactly. Well, you'll see that's not the case. But yeah, you know, we get paid in lump sums, kind of like before you go to make a record, you might get an advance of money. And then depending on how long it takes you to complete the record and go on tour, you have to live off that money. So, you know, in our case, it could have been you know, $50,000 or $80,000, but that might have to last you 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. And so it had basically been about 3 years at the time we started Blue Sky Research to the time that we had been on tour for that for a year. And I remember I went to my ATM and here I am on one of the biggest tours in rock with Stain and POD, these big bands. And I go to my ATM and I had like, you know, $16 in my account. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have, you know, a partial apartment payment to make at home and a $300 car payment. And, you know, my portion of a $150 electric bill. So, you know, I wasn't like I was living high in the hog. I was just trying to pay my bills at home and I was basically broke. So, so that was a real kind of bummer, kind of eye opener. And, you know, whereas our previous record, Welcome, had sold, it almost went gold. It sold like 475,000 copies because we had a really big song called Poem on that. And Blue Sky Research had sold about 125,000. Our single Calling didn't do as well as Poem did. So it just didn't really meet expectations. So I started seeing the writing on the wall, like, oh man, maybe I need to find something else to do here, or at least find another income. Mm-hmm. So I kind of put the word out there that I was looking for something to do in between tours after the Stain tour end. And a friend of mine was a General Motors employee, as you said, you know, auto industry is huge in Michigan, the big three, based in Michigan. So a friend of mine said, hey, they're launching this new General Motors plant in Lansing, which was about an hour drive from me. And they're just looking for people to help write processes and get the launch of these new vehicles going. And, you know, fortunately I'd gotten my college degree before we got our record deal. So I got a degree from University of Michigan. So he had the confidence that at least, you know, I could probably figure out how to type some stuff up if he helped me get a job. So I went there and I worked at the Lansing plant for 2 months while we had some time off. And then we decided to go on one last headlining tour in support of Blue Sky Research. And so I left the job for 2 months and then I came back and they had me back. And then we, you know, while I was working, I'd work all day at the plant and then I'd go and write and record our fourth record called Our Long Road Home. And that was the record you referred to, which, you know, 2 years after I started at the GM job in 2006, it was released in 2008. And yeah, I literally had a copy of Billboard magazine and I'm looking at it. I think we're at like number 71 or number 51 or something like that in Billboard. And I think we sold 7,700 units the first week. And, you know, which was a far cry from, you know, say even Welcome, which had sold like 51,000 the first week and we debuted at number 17. So yeah, it was, you know, it was a really mixed feeling. I had two kids at the time. My oldest was probably about two and my youngest was, you know, about one. And yeah, it was just a weird feeling. It was like, yep, I did the right thing. This record didn't start off as good as the other ones did, but it's still really weird. To your point, you know, you said you still kind of want to always like pretend that, oh yeah, well, I'm really this cool guy in this band, but really I'm sitting behind a cube looking at my old band's name in Billboard magazine. So yeah, it was, I think I knew I made the right decision, but it definitely took a while of getting used to, okay, now I'm this corporate guy and that's my past, right?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to let go. And I remember after, I think 2000, you know, Primer 55 did our last big tour in 02. And then the main guy, Bobby Burns, and I started a band here in town. And then he gets a call from Soulfly to go play bass for Soulfly. And he politely asked, you know, my opinion. And I told him he was an idiot if he didn't take it. And then, I remember then that's when I went on to do more, you know, just meaningless jobs. And then, you know, I would check, you know, videos online or photos and there's Bobby playing in front of, you know, 80,000 people at some festival in Europe. And here I am like, you know, tossing pizza dough. So it was, that was, I guess my moment with that. But, let's jump back to the happy times, to the, you know, the early days of Taproot. And,
sure.
Just a quick, like, you know, maybe how did you guys come together? You know, how did the band form in the late 90s?
I went to the University of Michigan and I met Phil Lipscomb, who would become our bass player. I met him at orientation. So August of 94, we met, we kind of hit it off right away. We lived in the same dorm room which was in North Campus, and you had to take a bus down to Main Campus. So anyone that was on North Campus became pretty close with one another. So I actually ended up living in the same hall as Taproot's singer, Steve Richards' cousin. So his name was Mark Carlson. So, you know, in talking to Mark about music, you know, I was a big like Metallica guy and Mark was a big Smashing Pumpkins guy. So we're always kind of hit it off and debating about, you know, who's a cooler guitar player, James Hetfield or Billy Corgan, right? So,
I mean, is there even an argument there?
Exactly. That was my argument.
Right.
So then in talking to music, he says, oh, my cousin's this great drummer and he's in this band. So we went and saw one of these old bands called Throw, and Steve Taproot Singer is this, he's a fantastic like double bass drummer. Like he can totally play, you know, all the Joey Jordison stuff. And so we kind of hit it off. And then, you know, my sophomore year, we moved into a house and we kind of turned our dining room into just a big jam room. We had a couple of guitar players in the house with us. I had my drums set up, and Steve and then Taproot's guitarist Mike would come over because they were in bands together. And so me and him, you know, me and Phil, who lived with me, Taproot's bass player, and then Steve and Mike would all come over and we'd jam. So the first version of Taproot was Steve had always been a drummer, but he decided he wanted to start singing. And they thought, well, we're going to do this kind of futuristic thing. We're going to have a drum machine and no drummer. So the first Taproot show was, you know, Phil, Steve, and Mike, bass, vocals, guitar, no drums, just a drum machine. And they were really kind of doing the rap rock thing. You know, we were really big fans. We got the Limp Bizkit $3 Bill Y'all album really early. Mm-hmm. It was at a used record store. And yeah, it just kind of blew us all away. Like those first three songs, you know, Pollution and Stuck, and it was like, wow, this is cool. You know, this is kind of the next evolution of Korn, we thought. We're all big Korn fans. And so I think that's what they wanted to do. And basically the drum machine kind of blew up and it was this big disaster. I was at the show in Jackson, Michigan. And I think the next day the three guys came over and said, hey, you want to be in our band as a live drummer? So, that was in 97 by the time that happened. So, yeah, you know, we started playing shows around Detroit and Ann Arbor. We're from Ann Arbor. And, you know, we were going to a studio in Ferndale, Michigan called The Woodshop. And, you know, we'd sit around and we'd write, you know, 3, 4, 5 songs, go lay them down for $400 or $500. And then we'd go to the computers at U of M's computer lab and we'd burn our own CDs. And then, you know, Mike's teacher or Mike's mom was a teacher. So she had one of those big cutting boards from school, you know?
Oh yeah.
So we made our own CD cases and all that stuff. And then we'd go burn our own CDs. Back then it took like 15 minutes to burn one CD. So, so we'd get there at like 6 a.m. and try to take over like 3 or 4 computers before the U of M students actually started getting there and try to knock out like 10 of them or something. And, you know, yeah, we were pretty early on the whole internet thing too. There was always us and Adema were around. Well, actually, they're called Juice back then. They became Adema. And so we were really active on kind of some of those early message boards. And, you know, really we just kind of people started hearing about us and then sending us checks or cash for these little burn CDs. And, you know, ultimately, like, you know, the name kind of spread. We actually sent a demo to Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit, and he called us back right away and said, hey, I really like what you guys are doing. And so, yeah, there's just a lot going on, you know, early then. We were kind of forming a really great grassroots fan base. And, you know, once people heard that Fred was interested, then, you know, that word kind of started spreading. And before you know it, like System of a Down's managers interested in what we're doing. And we had this guy from Arista Records fly up to see us. And then we're getting a call to go showcase for Rick Rubin. So it's kind of like, you know, at that time, I think, you know, so now we're talking like 98, 99. Mm-hmm. And I think all the labels were kind of, they all kind of wanted their version of what they thought the next nu metal thing was going to be, I think, you know.
I was there for all that, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, every label kind of wanted their version of what their big band was going to be. So I think that's what, you know, we ultimately ended up signing with Atlantic. And you know, I think we were supposed to be their, you know, Linkin Park or Disturbed or whatever you want to call it. So,
right. So So just real quick, I mean, obviously the whole Fred Durst voicemail resurfaced again since you wrote about it, and then I think Loudwire or somebody picked it up again, like, hey, remember that time Fred Durst called out Taproot? But I remember it was that year 2000 or whatnot when that actually happened, and you guys put it out. Did you put it out on the album itself, or like maybe like a hidden track or something?
So it's funny, I never got a straight answer on this. We didn't put it on any of the records because we didn't want it to date the record. And we're pretty sure that our manager must have leaked it, at least online. And then somebody just, when that was recirculating, somebody said they thought that it was a hidden track on one of the sampler tapes or CDs that were sent out. I don't remember if that's true or not. And the fact that some people were saying, oh yeah, it was the last track on our first CD, Gift, and that's not true. So then I'm like, okay, well, I'm questioning everything now. So I don't know if it was on any sampler tapes or CDs, but it definitely made its rounds around the internet. So
yeah, it made it to, you know, to when I lived in Nashville, you know, I had it. I remember hearing it and going, oh my God, you know, first off, I thought it was a pretty ballsy move to release it. And then, you know, I think it, you know, it maybe kind of backfired on Fred a little bit, you know, because it actually gave you guys some sort of notoriety that may or may not have been there prior to that.
Sure. Yeah. I think we always kind of viewed it as both a positive and a negative. I mean, it would have been best if we didn't have to tick him off. But like you said, I mean, some degree, no press is bad press, they say. And
you're right.
It definitely got people's attention. And a lot of people, you know, almost, you know, once the kind of masses started turning on Fred for whatever reason, that almost kind of, you know, I mean, there were definitely some radio stations that said, hey, we don't like Limp Bizkit anymore, so we're going to play Taproot in place of where we used to play Limp Bizkit. So, you know, in that regard, it worked out for us. And you know, who knows? I mean, I don't spend a whole lot of time wondering what could have been, but it probably definitely would have been, you know, maybe a quicker situation, but maybe a faster burn. And so I don't know. I think it all worked out the way it was supposed to, you know?
Yeah, I think that was one of the questions I was going to have for you was it what you, you know, if you guys ever kind of regretted not going with Fred, because I mean, at the time, you know, Fred had, you know, he had broken Stained. He was messing around with that band Cold. Seemed like there were a couple other bands that kind of came in and out of his stable, you know, and then Taproot would have been that next band. So, I mean, I don't know if you guys maybe feel like in retrospect that, yeah, you did make the right decision.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'll just speak for myself on it because, well, I think all the guys probably would agree. I mean, we definitely always made decisions that we felt were in the interest of keeping what we thought the integrity of the band should be, and that we didn't want to be a band that was just trying to make a hit song or something. And, you know, we even met with Howard Benson for the second record. So he had just come off the big POD record, and he did the Flyleaf record. So he was kind of known for taking these bands and making them hit songs. And he straight up told us, hey, if you guys want hits, you should record a record with me. If you don't want hits, then I don't want to work with you. And we're like, okay, yeah, we're not about that. We're not trying to, you know, we're not trying to make hits. And so, you know, I think that's probably more along the lines of where a relationship with Fred would have gone. Just, you know, even, you know, talking to Aaron Lewis, I did finally get the guts to ask him one time on tour, you know, hey, did Fred ever talk about us? Was any bad blood there? And he says, no, you know, he's, you know, he is who he is. He does his thing, you know? And, you know, I guess the thing that I definitely don't regret about, you know, not signing with Fred was that, you know, if we would have signed to his imprint, which I think was Flip on Interscope, then, you know, Flip would have always had like a piece of that action. And mm-hmm. I, you know, the way I understand it, it may have even been like an additional piece to what the Interscope piece would have done. So, you know, I think that we definitely had a little more autonomy by not going with them. And I think that at least, you know, we're kind of proud that we were able to stick to our guns in that regard, you know?
You know, it's funny. I've told this story on the podcast, and I promise listeners, I'll retire it after this time. But I had a band in Nashville And we opened for Limp Bizkit in 97 on that on the $3 Bill Y'all tour. Like I kind of in the same vein, I had seen them open for Korn a few months earlier before the album came out, and I saw that they were coming through town. I went to the promoter and I was like, hey, you know, if you put my band on the bill, I'll flyer the hell out of it and, you know, get as many people here as possible. And I was 18. I just graduated high school, and you know, we play. Fred comes up to me afterwards. Hey, man, I love your band. I would love. I'm starting to record bands in my studio in Florida and blah blah blah. Like this whole spiel, right? But we didn't know much about that type stuff, so we didn't follow through with it. And then later on, I read an interview with Aaron Lewis. And he was like, yeah, we opened for Limp Bizkit. And he came up to us and he was like, hey, man, we're recording bands in down in my studio in Florida. And we followed through on it. And look at us now type stuff. And I always look back at that. And I'm like, man, I totally missed that opportunity.
For what it's worth. And I think I don't have any ill will towards him. And I think I paint a pretty good picture of our interactions with him and the whole band, because they treated us great. And you know, they were doing those guerrilla shows where they played on top of a building in Boston, and then they did one near Detroit. And so they had a day off in Detroit. We totally hung out with them on the bus, and we listened to the whole Significant Other record. And you know, Wes and John and Sam, they were all just like, oh yeah, we can't wait to hear what you guys do with your new stuff. And they're singing the lyrics to Come Back to us. And so, you know, they were super gracious, and we really got to have a great time with them, standing backstage watching a couple of those shows. And so, you know, we really had a good time. It was just a fun time. And Rob, I mean, I think back to Quest Live, which was the video show on MTV, and kind of the daily battle of the boy bands and then the hard rock band. So it was, you know, thinking Backstreet Boys versus Korn and Limp Bizkit. It was just a really fun time in the heavy music scene to see that, you know, it had reached a really kind of national level, and just to be a tiny part of that was really fun.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And one of those things too was, you know, when you guys first came out, I really gravitated towards the first album, and then the second album, which was Welcome, correct?
Yep, you got it.
Okay. Yeah, and then, you know, with Poem and all that stuff on it was, I was listening to it today, just kind of getting ready to talk to you, and I was like, God, this album is so good. And then, actually, I interviewed Toby Wright just a couple of months ago, and actually, we talked about recording that album, cool. And he had a lot of positive things to say about that.
Oh, that's really awesome. Yeah, he's super talented. We worked with Ulrich Wilde on Gift, and you know, I think that we were really new, obviously, to the studio, and listening back to that album, it was really raw. And once you record in the studio a couple of times, your ear definitely gets a lot more finely tuned as far as listening to the placement of, for me, it's for kick drum and snare drum and how the bass guitar is laying with the drums and all those pieces. And you know, I can listen to certain songs on Gift and go, man, that sounds really sloppy. But I think that's really, maybe whether people knew it or not, that might be what they gravitated towards, because it was kind of a raw sound. And then, you know, what Toby brought to the whole thing was just the next level of songwriting and thinking about different guitar layers and harmonies. And, you know, he really just kicked our ass. He was saying, you know, is that really the best you got for that bridge? Or, you know, does that B section really throw you into that chorus like it should? Is there a fill, like that little fill in Poem right before the chorus where it's like, dun, 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 that little drum thing, that was him saying, hey, you need to come up with a little something that is gonna throw you into that chorus. And rather than just playing a beat and all of a sudden you hit a crash cymbal and you're in the chorus. So he really taught us a lot about that stuff, about songwriting. And yeah, he was just fantastic to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, if Wikipedia is correct, I think, was it Poem was the number 5 most played rock song in 2002 or something crazy?
Yeah, I mean, that was a crazy time. This is kind of a funny story. We were playing, I remember we were playing in Philadelphia at the Trocadero, and it was right when, you know, Palm was kind of, it was doing well up until the record was released, and then the record was released in October, I think it was October 15th of 2002, and so then as soon as it was released, the song kept doing better and better at radio, and this radio station really was just playing the crap out of it, and our singer Steven had started doing this thing. He'd always kind of moshed in the mosh pits especially when we were on Ozfest. But his new thing when we were playing like these theaters was jumping off of balconies, and he'd have, he'd pull all the crowd over, come on, come on. He'd climb up on the balcony, and then he'd motion towards the crowd at the bottom, like, come on, come on, come on to catch me. And then he'd kind of do like this barrel roll and land on his back. And he was doing it from higher and higher heights. It started at like a, 5 or 6 foot balcony. And all of a sudden I'm looking up there and he's, 15, 20 feet in the air. And I guess the word had kind of started spreading to these promoters that, hey, you better watch out for this guy. He jumps off balconies and someone's going to get hurt and you're going to get sued or whatever. And I remember being on the phone with our manager before that show, and because it was sold out and it was a really tall balcony. And our manager goes, hey, dude, if you feel like it, just do it. He's like, if we get a lawsuit, I'll pay for it. He's like, this is great press. Just keep doing what you're doing, man. If you're feeling it, do it. So it was kind of like, it was just, everything was just really fun. It was amped up and the crowds were big and excited and the song was doing well. And yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. Another story I will retire soon from the podcast, but the year 2000 Ozfest, where actually Primer was on there with you guys. It was Primer and Ozzy and Godsmack and all that stuff. They were that tour. I actually, do you remember the carnival people that ran the little the booths out in the the main lot, I guess? They would, you would go up and you would like bust a balloon and you get a promo CD and, those type carny games. Well, I actually, in 2000, I went to Ozfest with some friends in St. Louis and I saw the Help Wanted sign, and I was 19 or 20 at the time, no care in the world. And I was like, all right, yeah, what's the Help Wanted sign about? Oh, well, you get up at 4 a.m., you set these rides up or you set these games up. You watch the shows all day and then you tear down at the end of the night and you go into the next city. So I actually did, I think 5 dates of that Ozfest with you guys, as part of the Carney crew. And, man, those dudes are crazy. But you guys were one of the standout bands I remember watching every night. And I remember being a bass player myself, watching your bass player. And I always remembered his like guitar strap, it was like a backpack or something. And that was always like it always stood out to me, but yeah, that was a fun Ozfest.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's he says he's always had back problems. So he said that I think it's called the slider. Mm-hmm. So it basically has the 2 straps instead of the 1, and it kind of balances out his bass. And yeah, it's one of those silly things. People are always like, oh, that must be a gimmick. That doesn't really do anything. He's like, no, it's because I got a bad back. So right. We had I'm trying to remember. It might have been 2001 we were on, when I think Jaeger was a bigger sponsor of the tour. And yeah, there was a guy that was running that, kind of booth, if you will, and he aptly named himself Jaeger Rob. And so, yeah, we were getting like free bottles of Jaeger, and that, I think it was called Baron Jaeger. It was like the honey Jaeger. And my gosh, we basically had as much of that stuff as we wanted. And I don't think I've really had a desire to touch it since, but yeah, there were some long days. I mean, you definitely had to pace yourself to, keep up with the next really hot day of people filled with, alcohol and black t-shirts wanting to hang out and party all day. Yeah. You couldn't go full on every day for sure.
No, you couldn't at all. Did you go to the, in Dallas, Vinny and Pantera had a, private thing at Vinny's, strip club there for the Ozfest crew, and, all the bands were there. Were you guys at that?
Yes, we were. I remember that. Yeah, actually, I can't remember, because we went to one of those places a couple of times with Pantera, but one night it was early in the tour, and I saw Vinny. It was the first time I kind of wanted to go like introduce myself, and I said, hey, I'm in this band Taproot, we're on the second stage, big fans, they're great to meet you. And he gets real close to me, he's like, I heard you guys are the best band on the second stage. I'm going to come watch y'all. And I was like, oh, no way. I mean, Paul was totally an idol of mine, oh, drumming yeah. idol of mine. So I thought So I think Vulgar Display of Power is probably top five best albums. So yeah, sure enough, he did. He came over a couple times and watched us, and yeah, you know, him and Dimebag are always just running around Ozfest. They always had a camera with them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you ever watched any of those old Pantera DVDs, you know, they're just always running around doing pranks and saying funny stuff. So yeah, it was really cool. Yeah, I saw him again after Dimebag had passed away. I think we did a show with Audio Slave and maybe Stain, a couple other bands in Vegas. And it was like 6 months after Diamond had passed. And yeah, it's like, hey, I don't know if you remember me, but I just, you know, really sorry about lost your brother. And, you know, I've been really thinking about you and praying for you. And he was just like, yeah, man, thanks. Been really hard. You know, we definitely miss him. And so, yeah, I was glad I got to just kind of see a little piece of that too, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Music history.
Oh yeah, they were you know, Pantera's still my favorite band of all time, so getting to see them every night on that Ozfest too was an amazing thing too. Getting to see Pantera play in Dallas was always a highlight of that too for me. Let's jump into one thing real quick and then we'll get into the book, but you took part in the 15th anniversary of Welcome at the Machine Shop. Were you guys taken aback how quickly that sold out, and then you know, how quickly the internet blew up over you guys getting back together?
Yeah, it really, I think it was especially I've been pretty active on social media for, I think, a couple of 3 years. And, you know, I was really surprised that so many people were, you know, still kind of interested or excited about Taproot, because, you know, I think even when Taproot did the last full tour that they did, which I'd say maybe it was 5 or 6 years ago, of course, I was out of the band, you know, I mean, frankly, Phil told me that there were some nights where they'd play to hardly any people, or, you know, it might be like, you know, 50 or 75. And so I think they really felt like, you know, something had changed for the worse, and, you know, that really kind of nobody cared anymore. And so I kind of started noticing that, you know, a lot of people had reached out to me and just, you know, hey, what's going on with you guys? Are you ever going to do anything else? And, you know, I was active enough on social media that I was kind of fielding a lot of those questions. And so, you know, probably for about the last couple of years, I was saying to, you know, Steve and Phil, you know, hey, we should really consider, you know, playing every so often. And, you know, a lot of people had expressed interest in me playing with them again too. And, you know, I didn't want to step on anybody's toes because I really liked their current drummer. I think he's a great drummer. He's a cool guy. I consider him a friend. So I think we're always kind of trying to figure out how that could all work. And so, yeah, we came up with this idea of, you know, hey, our biggest record's got a anniversary that ends in a 5. So it's kind of a fitting number to celebrate, I guess, in 5s. so we started toying around with the idea of doing a 15th anniversary of Welcome, playing it in its entirety. And yeah, so once we announced it, it, you know, sold out, I think, in 36 hours. And you know, we had a second show, and kind of by the day of the show, that one had sold out. And so, yeah, I think it was just kind of a cool, I guess, reminder or affirmation that there is still interest out there in the band. And, you know, for me, it was kind of one of those full circle moments, like when I talked about looking at the Billboard magazine and thinking, okay, well, that's, you know, that's my past. Now I've got this corporate job, and, you know, I can no longer introduce myself as the guy that's in the band. That's what I'm really doing. For me, it was kind of like, it kind of connected my past with my present. And that was really fun, because there's, you know, there's people at work that find out that I was in the band. And so I'll get emails, you know, from someone at our Chicago office with this big real estate company that says, oh my gosh, I was such a big fan growing up. I can't believe we worked together in the same company.
That's awesome.
So it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you know, my past can still be a part of my past, and also to some degree a part of my present and future. And, you know, that's really fun. I really thought that when I left the band, that was all going to be kind of put back here and forgotten about. And it's really fun that it can still be a part of my life today. So yeah, it was awesome.
All right, and then on to the book. You know, like I said, True Rock Stars, 12 Guiding Principles for Success and Happiness. from what I can tell, it's kind of like a, it's like kind of a Taproot history book, but I mean, I'm guessing you add in, you share the stories to bridge to the success and happiness, I guess is what are the principles for success and happiness, right?
I would consider it kind of part autobiography, part inspiration / self-help, if you will. So, you know, a lot of people had, I kind of think I said at the beginning, had were interested in my story and interested, well, you know, how did this guy, you know, and I was valedictorian in my high school too. So people were like, how'd this valedictorian guy go to being a potential doctor to rock guy? And then, you know, I'm an executive in my company, now Fortune 500 company. So they're kind of like, how did that happen? And so I was never able to, you know, I could tell my story on how it happened, but I didn't know what things I was doing that, you know, kind of allowed me to be successful in these different areas. So I started by kind of writing my autobiography, and then I thought, well, you know, I've always thought it was kind of annoying when like a really successful business guy or a really successful, you know, race car driver or actor or whatever you want to call it, you know, writes a book and says, you know, this is how to be successful, because well, it worked for them, but you know, how can anyone else necessarily pull something from that that's going to work for them? So I kind of wanted to, I went down the road of saying, okay, is there a formula for success and happiness, and how could I go about trying to find that? So I started with the top 20 self-help and business books of all time. So it's your 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Think and Grow Rich, Win Friends and Influence People, you know, Who Moved My Cheese, The Power of Habit. So, and I started literally on a wall, started figuring out what were all the themes in this book that were either around success or around happiness. And so I took all the books and I plotted them across the top of the wall. And then as these themes started emerging, I started plotting them down the left-hand side of the wall. And I'm using Post-it notes. And as I'm going through all these books that were, you know, kind of the best sellers of their kind, I wanted to see if there was any unifying themes between all of those. And, you know, I noticed that there was a big division between kind of that nonfiction literature. You had books that were either business books that were telling you, here's how you can be more financially successful or gain more power in your career. But they didn't really talk about, hey, are you really happy at home? Are you really fulfilled? How are your relationships? Do you have a relationship with your significant other or your kids, if that's meaningful to you? It didn't touch on any of that stuff. But then if you go over into the true kind of self-help realm, you've got, you know, this book by Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life. And you've got, you know, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, that really all these kind of books talk about, you know, how you can heal the wounds of your past, how you can improve your relationships, how you can live a more happy, fulfilled life. But there really wasn't any interaction, those two. So I was like, oh, this might be an opportunity where, you know, to me, success doesn't necessarily mean money or power. And, you know, and happiness, I think if you don't have happiness along with your success, then if you're looking at a broad life view, then you're not really successful. I mean, you could have $4 million, but if you're like miserable and you're depressed, then what does that really mean? So yeah, as those kind of common themes started emerging, you know, I picked up on other little pieces of literature that I liked or articles or quotes. And, you know, I started kind of figuring out what those common themes were. I started condensing and moving stuff around on the board. It's almost like in the movies where you know, someone's trying to solve a mystery and you see all these pictures and cities and stuff and a map on the wall and they're, you know, taking strings and drawing lines between things. That's kind of what I was doing. And when I broke down, I came up with 12 common themes that were common for success and happiness. And so, yeah, so then what I did was I took those, I called them 12 guiding principles. I translated almost all of them into actionable things. So I'll give you an example. One is, choose happiness and fulfillment. Happiness is a choice. Fulfillment is a choice. You know, people that are happy do not wait for happiness to come to them. They make a decision to do things that are going to improve their life and make them happy and feel fulfilled. So they're all actionable items like that. And I took all 12 of those and then I said, okay, is there any way that I can align these chronologically with some of my life experiences? So, you know, where they may have applied during a period of my life. So that's what I did. So basically 12 chapters of the book are the 12 guiding principles. And the book starts off in my early years, and I do spend, I'd say probably, I don't know, maybe 2/5 to a half of the book talking about the Taproot years and the music industry stuff, because a lot of people are interested in that and it's kind of fun to tell the story. So I'd say, you know, almost half the book is talking about the music industry and the Taproot stuff. But then I also talk about a lot of the things that I learned growing up and then kind of post Taproot within my business career and my family. You know, we fostered and adopted my daughters. So the two of my 5 kids. So I talk a lot about, you know, foster care and adoption and, you know, just a lot of things that I've experienced in my life that I feel that I feel a lot of people can kind of learn from and hopefully take a little piece of it and apply something positive to their life.
Yeah, when I saw that you had 5 kids, I was like, Jesus Christ. But then I realized I have 3, so it's not too far off. But yeah, 5. You know, once you get into that 4 and 5, I think that's crazy talk, man.
So, you know, you'd be surprised. I think when you get to 3, you've already had to learn how to multitask. So, you know, adding 2 more is definitely a change in the beginning, but it's not as crazy as you might think. And here's the craziest thing. So I manage a big team of people at work and, you know, managing a big family at home, a lot of things I learn here help me at work and vice versa. And it's really interesting. You can draw a lot of common themes around just managing people and how to get a lot of people trying to go in the same direction. So, you know, I'm crazy busy at work, I'm crazy busy at home, and they actually kind of help each other.
Nice. Well, man, how can people nice. Pre-order the book, and how can they expect to find it? Will it be in stores? All that fun stuff.
Yeah, thanks. So right now I am basically selling it through a Square Up store. So I don't know if you publish a link here, but the link would be squareup.com/store/true rockstars. But probably the easiest people that are on Facebook would be just search True Rockstars in Facebook. And I have a page there and you can click the shop now link and you can buy the book right there. So longer term. So what I'm doing now is I'm self-publishing. So I'm printing these. I'm having a printing place, printing them up in Ann Arbor right now. And so I've got a pre-order pack for $19.99 plus shipping, which includes a signed copy of the book, a signed drumstick, a signed copy of my band Westfall's new EP, and I'm becoming friends with this organization called Buckle Up for Chi. So they actually started this organization because Chi from Deftones passed away, essentially from not wearing a seatbelt. And his family is really supportive of this initiative. So you get a Buckle Up for Chi sticker. It's actually just a good reminder. In fact, I'm one who typically has never liked wearing a seatbelt, and it actually reminds me to wear my seatbelt. So yeah, you can get that pre-order pack, $19.99. Go to Facebook, True Rockstars, and you'll get a book, a CD, a stick, and a sticker. And you know, once I feel like everyone's got the hard copy that wants one, then, you know, probably in the next couple months, 3 months, I'll go the Amazon route, make sure it's available for Kindle and all that stuff. But, yeah, basically if you go the Amazon route, if somebody wanted a signed book, I would have to buy it myself, have it shipped to my house, sign it, and then ship it to somebody else. So I'm going to keep it all in house till anyone who wants one has one.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, we're going to end this with myself off of Welcome. Can you give a little story behind that song? Do you remember anything about, you know, the writing, recording, anything of that song?
Yeah, so it's funny. Whenever we wrote albums, about 3/4 of the way through, we'd start to see how the album's taking shape and decide if there's anything that we're missing. And for Welcome, we realized that there were a lot of melodic tunes on there and that we knew we wanted a couple heavier songs to play as bashers live. So myself was an attempt to make one of those heavier ones that was going to be fun to play live. And, you know, I think it's interesting because here's two things I say about myself that I love. In the chorus where Steve's, you know, screaming no more, he's almost like harmonizing with the scream, like, yeah, no. And I'm like, I don't think I've ever heard anyone kind of try to harmonize with the scream, but that's what it sounds like to me. And then, you know, another cool thing about that song in the bridge, he uses the verse, just need some time to myself. And we kind of flew in the chorus of Again and Again, one of our songs on Gift that says that same thing. So that was a really cool piece of that song. And I'll tell one more story about myself.
All right.
We got to play on Last Call with Carson Daly. It was the late show on NBC. And we got to meet Carson Daly briefly before we played on his show. And he was super cool, super gracious. And I remember the main thing that he said, one of the first things he said was, "Oh man, I love your new disc. Like myself, that song is just one of my favorite songs." And it was just cool. Like you could tell, since he picked out one of the songs that wasn't one of the singles, you could tell that he actually listened to it and he actually, you know, was sincere and was interested in the band. And he wore a Tapper hat for a while after that on TRL. That was cool too. So, yeah, myself's a good choice. So thanks for your time, man. This was really fun and awesome.
Yeah, Jared, man, thanks. And like I said, here is Myself by Tapper.
If life was a game, could I win in the end? If I was sane, would I fuck it up all over again? These questions and answers can help me redefine myself. And I thank your open ears for all the help. No! Stay the same, how long will I last? Yet if I change, will I still just be alone and typecast? Professional answers can't help me to design myself. So I thank your open arms for all the help. No! I've got no doubt that when my dreams come true, it's because of you and the fact that I let you. No! What I see for myself, I need to change for my health, I need a better way of
All right, thank you once again to Jared Montague from Taproot, formerly of Taproot, now author and drummer extraordinaire out there. So thanks to Jared, man. Cool guy.
Very, very cool interview, man. That's very interesting, the whole author part of it.
Yeah, had a lot of good stuff to say. And then we're on to the next phase of Talk To Me, and I know that there have been a lot of changes lately with John coming on, new show intros and things like that, but I think we're going to do one big change right now. And I've been talking to my good friend over there at metalnexus.net, longtime supporter of the show, and he was pitching to me the idea of taking over their or creating their podcast. And for the longest time, I was thinking about, you know, rebranding and everything else. And then I felt like I maybe put too much into the Talk To Me name and then Talk To Me brand and, you know, all the blabbermouth coverage and things like that. So we came to an agreement. And I think Talk To Me will now be Talk To Me, you know, semicolon or whatever the fuck that is, colon, the Metal Nexus podcast. So we're combining forces. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun to have not only our stuff going on, but the metalnexus.net crew over there are going to be also supporting the podcast. So it's going to be just kind of like a new infrastructure and a new venture for the show. So it's on to big and better things over here at the Talk To Me compound.
Definitely. I know it's going to be a very cool partnership. It'll get us out to, you know, some more people, broaden the audience a little bit, which is always a good thing. And when you first brought it up to me, I was like, well, that's a really cool idea. So, I want to thank them definitely for having us be a part of what they're doing. And it should be a really good partnership, man. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be very cool.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So the next week, everything's going to stay the same. The feed will stay the same. You know, you don't have to subscribe to a new feed. The only thing that'll be a little bit different is when you go to do your sharing for your shout out, you'll be sharing the metalnexus.net story behind the podcast and things like that. So it's going to be a lot more interactive and a lot more content from the show. And, you know, this kind of comes down to, the main guy over there, BJ, was at Louder Than Life. And we had been talking maybe a couple of weeks before Louder Than Life about kind of this merger happening. And, at Louder Than Life, he and I shared a table and, over the course of the weekend, we, hashed out, here's what I need, here's what you need. And I think we came to a pretty good conclusion. And, he sent over the kind of what he expects from the show. And I've sent over what I expect, you know, from his website. And I don't see anything wrong with this. And I don't see any negatives. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun on both ends.
Yeah, definitely. I know you were telling me about it when you were texting me from the Rockin' Pod before you got hammered. And I was like, wow, look at you, the businessman.
That wasn't the rock.
I gotta say, I'm glad that you I'm glad you didn't rebrand, because it's you built it up. And so I think it's cool that they were amicable to that request. And I'm glad we're doing it the way we are.
Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun. So next week in your feed, you will see a new logo and a new intro to the podcast. A couple of different segments, I think, will happen. But I mean, at the core of the show, will stay the same. You know, John and I will stay the same, interviewing, you know, wonderful rock stars from all around the world. That'll all stay the same. So let us know what you think of the change when it happens. But be open and be honest, but don't be too honest.
But you could be honest, because you get all the good stuff and all the hate goes to me. So remember, I'm the hate buffer. So
right. The inaugural guest of Talk To Me, the Metal Nexus podcast, will be Matt Hafey of Trivium, making his return to Talk To Me, talking about the new album, The Sin and the Sentence, which I think is an absolutely amazing album. If you're a Trivium fan of any era of the band, I think you will enjoy it. And I recorded that interview a couple of days ago, and man, I could talk to that dude for hours and hours, but I had a good 40 minutes with him, and boy, we got into some weird stuff.
That's awesome. Yeah, that new record is slamming, man. That is a damn good record.
All right, well, so for the Talk To Me podcast, I am Joshua Toomey.
I'm John Drake.
And we will talk to you guys next Thursday.
Psycho female blowing up the phone line. You need to tighten that screw, it's been loose for a long time. I've been slammed with some bad luck. Soon I'm gonna bring you doom with the buck, buck. And now you're ducked up, go so right loose with a 30-yard freestyle labeled hostile by my profile. Must be all the madness, you and all your
take a step to this business. What's with all the business? I get paid to take the microphone and slay the stage. Stay away from all the bros in my band and all the fans and all my friends when the cash is coming in. Or I'll be slamming them all through the wall with the ink on my flesh. And the yes, yes, y'all. No 9 to 5, I'll still survive. I keep my engine on that amp like the Chattanooga Jam. That's all we need, another fancy. Planet on this earth, motivated by greed. You wanna play that game, bitch? You think a dance for my cash is your ass that I'm blasting? Oh, you wanna play that game, bitch? Think a dance for my cash is your ass that I'm blasting. Are you bad luck? You stop. A Pepsi, just one Pepsi, far from suicidal. Still, I get them tendencies, bringing back the memories that I really miss. When I reminisce, rocking back in the 80s. Live, my attitude to do it. Die, went to with a maggot, but now I'm just super. Fly bound for the boundaries, no limit, G. Fat ass rhythms driven by my destiny. Your sound's in my pocket. Proclaim to regain that essence. Press it cause I'm hot, style. Labeled by my profile, indeed I am. I am a thing, hostile when it comes to free.
Wow.